Hello and welcome. I'm Matt, and by the grace of the Nashville Public Library, I'm here to talk about the creative process and the joy of appreciating the creations of others. Thankfully, I'm not going to do it alone. Joining me today is multi-instrumentalist, composer, producer, and member of an ever-fluctuating number of musical projects, Jesse Peck.
Hey, how's it going, Matt?
Hello.
Thanks for having me on.
Of course. Good to see you. So, remind me, like, what all are you a member of right now, musical project-wise?
I've cut back on the number of things that I would claim as my full-time creative passions and really tried to focus my energies on them a little bit more. In the past, I've been in a couple different bands. I think you'll remember when we were in school together, Edge of Reality. Uh-huh. And I know you've, maybe not on this podcast, but I know you've talked to some of those band members.
Oh, yeah.
It was kind of a prog metal kind of project. These days, I am playing mostly piano in a band called Flummox, which is another kind of proggy band. And aside from that project, I've really cut back on a lot of the other projects that I was kind of in full time. I play guitar now sometimes in a band called Young Robot. Hmm. I am really trying to focus on my own music because it's very different writing. I'm sure you know, yeah, writing with a group of people in any creative setting versus writing your own material. And so I've been trying to focus on my own material and then, yeah, playing piano with Flummox and guitar with Young Robot on occasion. I was in another band recently that I don't know if you got the chance to see, but is tied into the Edge of Reality people as well, called Crusade. I joined them pretty much right after I left Edge of Reality. But I recently cut back on that because I found that I was just splitting my passions a little bit too broadly.
Yeah.
So I've really cut back a lot.
Yeah. And as you alluded to, we went to Belmont together. We've known each other for many years now.
Yes.
We're getting older.
Yes.
So obviously, it felt like at Belmont specifically, there was this culture of if you're in a band, you're probably in six. Unless you're like maybe the main creative driving force behind an individual band, and maybe then you're only in one or two. Mm-hmm. How do you find people who try to like keep up music in a post-grad scenario, or even the difference between people who do it sort of casually versus as making it their full-time job? Mm-hmm. How much do they split themselves that you've seen?
That's a great question. I think that it does vary a bit depending on what you studied at school. Like a lot of the musicians at Belmont that I still am aware of in the Nashville scene, you know, if they're playing live every night, you know, maybe on Broadway or... So it depends on also what their instrument is. A lot of the guitar majors that were in my class do play with just one artist mainly. When they go out on the road, they'll tour with usually like a bigger like country group, and they may not be the main driving force for that. And so they may offer up their services as an instrumentalist to a couple different artists. They have their main one they go out on tour with, and then when they're in town, when they're off of tour, they may pick up gigs as just a guitarist for this other person's vision. And they'll split themselves, you know, maybe they'll have two or three people like that that they can fill in with on their home base when they're not on tour, but their main project is touring. There's other people who don't like the touring thing. They'll either put together a band to play regularly downtown, or maybe they just float from project to project. And people like that may split themselves more, but I don't think they get as attached to that work, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. It's kind of gun for hire stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that takes a lot less mental, as far as the creative process. It's not as much of an investment on your end as it is, like you said, kind of more of like a work for hire thing versus if you're doing your own thing, it can be a labor of love. It can be kind of more of a... I wouldn't say casual. I think that's the word you used. It's not necessarily that you're not doing it seriously.
Oh, sure.
But it may be not paying the bills the way that touring for like a bigger artist might.
For sure.
So people like that, that make the time, which I can attest because I've done this since we graduated, people who take the time to do the labor of love thing and play the music they want to play, you know, play their own stuff, play in a band where it's not paying the bills, those are the people who really have to split themselves because they're taking the time creatively to invest in doing their own music and making their own art. And then on top of that, to pay the bills, they're going to need to do some other things. You know, I still wait tables a couple days a week. I've been able to cut back on that lately, thankfully.
Congratulations.
And that's been a good feeling. And that allows me to put more time and more energy into the other things I'm doing, which lately I'm trying to really make, like I said, my own stuff and the bands that I consider an actual creative outlet for my own writing. I've tried to make those the priority.
Hmm.
But I still have to do other stuff, too. And that's usually the work-for-hire thing. You know, I might help somebody that needs, you know, I need guitar for this, or I need, can you help me program drums? Not all artists have the same skill set. And so amongst ourselves within the community, we often are able to split ourselves in a way where we're still working with our friends, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I've had really good guitar player friends of mine that they can shred, they can play circles around me, that don't really know the ins and outs of recording and producing, be like, hey, I just need drums for this demo. I don't have the budget to get them recorded. Could you just program some for me? And I know, you know, how to open my computer and program those drums for them.
So this is something I was trying to remember. Did you have a minor at college?
I didn't have a minor. I did a double emphasis. So
that's right.
So I was in the School of Music,
uh-huh.
which is a like an arts degree, which is separate from a lot of our friends were probably in the music business school, uh-huh. which is actually a business degree. What I did was I did the arts degree in the School of Music, but they had different, kind of like a minor, they had different quote unquote emphases
right.
that you could pick. So I did a double. I did a performance and I did a business emphasis. The business stuff was kind of helpful, but I will say a lot of what I have learned since graduating has just come from just doing work.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering, because I certainly remembered you having fun with a lot of like production adjacent stuff in college, but mm-hmm. you know, listening to your recent output, it's clean. Like the production is, at least to my like plebeian ears, really good. And I didn't know at what point you had started to develop that skill set, among other things.
That's a good point. It is something that you can learn these days on your own. You don't need to go to music school to do those things. And the things that I learned in music school have been useful to me, but a lot of what I've learned has come more so just over the past years of, you know, since I graduated, wanting to do the thing, wanting to make my own music, and I've learned to produce more so by myself. You know, I might watch the occasional YouTube video, or I think I mentioned to you earlier the music podcast that I listen to from Mr. Bill. Mm-hmm. You know, he's a producer, so I get all sorts of tidbits from that. But it comes out of the interest of wanting to make my own, to create my own sounds.
Yeah.
And I appreciate you saying that you can hear the quality of it, because I didn't know what I was doing in that regard when I was in music school, because we were focused on the academics of it,
yeah.
you know, the music theory, and I wasn't studying tech mm-hmm. or recording or engineering while I was in school, but I've put the time in since then.
Yeah.
And so I would hope that, I don't know, anybody listening to this that has a creative outlook and maybe wishes they went to school or maybe doesn't feel like they can figure out what they're doing, I think in this day and age, you can find the information you need pretty much anywhere. And that's not to say if you're considering music school that you shouldn't. I mean, we wouldn't have met
nope.
otherwise. And I'm sure you know plenty of people in our circle that, you know, that school, that community really brought us together. So there's definitely value to it.
Yeah, I follow like more visual artists than musicians. Mm-hmm. And I know that there's often, like every 6 months or so, discourse around like, is art school worth it? I assume something similar happens with musicians.
Absolutely. I see videos on it very often. There's a couple YouTubers that are in the music, either music production or writing, a couple different people that just have a platform on YouTube. And they'll talk about these things, how they're like, yeah, I didn't study this stuff in school, but here I am on this platform
mm-hmm.
and you're my audience and I'm telling you things and you believe me. And that makes it sound sketchy. They know what they're doing, but their expertise doesn't come from the academic side. And that's the cool thing about a creative field, is that there is an academic side, but then there's also just a real life, you know, anyone can make art, anyone can be a creative. You don't need to study it to create.
And you certainly don't need to try and make money. Like, sometimes you have to try and make money, but you don't have to make things. Mm-hmm. And you know, to the point of where we're leading here, one of the things I like to try and do with this podcast is zoom out a little bit from the creative expertise of a particular guest or even myself and try to, like, zone in on what the things that we're talking about mean for creative people in general. And I think you've already hit on some really important stuff, like, you know, talking about how you were metering down some of the projects you were involved in that, you know, other people or maybe you at previous times in your career would have thought, well, this is just what I should do or what I've always done. Mm-hmm. But it isn't necessarily serving you.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And there is a huge component to creativity because it's so deeply personal that you have to understand yourself and your own needs.
Mm-hmm.
And what you're looking for. And, you know, at a certain point that starts to sound selfish.
Yes. And it is, I've been wrestling with this, and I'm sure you can probably tell as I just brought up these points, it's something that I'm actively learning right now. And, you know, a lot of these projects that I cut back on recently, there was a lot of inner turmoil for myself of like, why am I doing them in the first place? Mm. Because like you said, it was like, I thought I had to, or I thought I was supposed to be doing those things. You know, if I'm not constantly busy, am I really doing it? And that ties into what you said of, you know, the artist or to be a creative, you don't need to be trying to make money. There's a kind of hustle mentality that, well, you have to monetize your hobbies, or, you know, if you're going to create something, you have to create it as a product or with somebody in mind to sell it to.
You're leaving money on the table.
Yeah. But obviously that's not the reality. And well, I say obviously, but here I am a couple years down the line out of school, what we graduated, what, like 7 years ago?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm waking up. I'm having this realization that I'm doing all these things, but they're not all fulfilling. And then as you just brought up, you come to that realization and then you're like, well, if I'm just doing it for me, isn't that selfish?
Yeah.
But what I'm realizing is by prioritizing the things that are fulfilling, it makes me a more valuable creative to the people that I am, that are listening.
Yep.
You know, whether I'm making it, quote unquote, for myself or for my audience, if I'm making what is fulfilling, it will be a better result.
Mm-hmm.
Not a better product, but a better result. Something that people will connect with more.
Yeah.
And I think that is not selfish. I think that end result puts some individuality back into what you're doing. And it is kind of zooming out and asking some big questions, but I think it is worth it to do. And I don't think it's selfish.
Mm. I think this is all incredibly valuable creative insight and conversation. But before we get too deeply in the creativity weeds, change gears slightly. What are you listening to recently? What are you excited about listening to in the last several months?
That's a great question. A lot of my inspiration musically comes from the music that I hear that when you pay attention to it, there's all sorts of detail and you can hear the attentiveness and the passion of the writer in the subtleties in the mixes. But at the same time, if you stop listening to it, you forget it's there.
Mm.
There's this transparency to it. And I'm referring to genres more on the ambient side, music that is written to kind of backdrop a specific mood. So like soundtracks, and whether that's for a movie, a video game, or, you know, even and this is, I don't say this to say this is what I'm listening to and finding like inspiration from, in the sense that I don't put this music on to enjoy.
Mm.
But, you know, even music that gets written for like commercials and stuff like that, the people who wrote that were like, okay, they're trying to sell this product. What sounds will make it more appealing, or how can I make something that matches what is happening but doesn't get in the way of the message of it?
Mm.
So those are the kinds of things that I find inspiring, and I find that a lot of music that's written for media is the music that tends to excel more in that area. So, like, I've been listening to a lot of, you actually turned me on to the Studio Ghibli franchise while we were in school, And I've just been going back and listening to a lot of those soundtracks because when I listen to them, I can see those scenes.
Yeah.
And so I try to bring that idea to my own music, even though I'm not writing music for a movie and it's not orchestral. I try to think, all right, well, what scene do I want this song to make? And it usually yields better results. As far as specific artists, I guess I could name drop. I don't know if you're familiar with Einar Solberg.
Mm-mm.
He is a Norwegian composer, and he is the frontman for a band called Leprous that I think we discovered around the Belmont days, if you remember. But he just put out a solo album recently, and it has a kind of cinematic feel to it, but it feels very personal. I think it's always interesting when an artist that is normally in a band setting, they're known for creating music in a specific outlet, when they branch out and put out something more personal, and you see how it compares to the band that they're in, because he's the main singer for Leprous, and you hear that voice in this new setting of his own music, and I feel like you get more of the artist that way than you do in the band setting. So yeah, Einar Solberg, the Ghibli soundtracks, and just I've just been putting on a lot of ambient music because I just find it's calming.
Mm-hmm.
Honestly, that's mainly what I've been listening to these days.
Nice. Yeah, I don't know. Obviously, we don't need to compare various practitioners of art to one another, but I don't know that film composers get better than Joe Saishi.
He's got it. I mean, you hear one of the scores to one of those Ghibli films, and you hear Hayashi's vision, I guess, is the best word for it.
Yeah, I think we were watching like one of the filmed concerts that he will usually conduct himself, and you know, talking to our mutual friend about that one of these times, and the main opening theme from Ponyo started playing, and it's just like, how does he know what water sounds like? Why does this sound and feel like the ocean without having anything resembling Foley? Like, it's remarkable.
Absolutely. I would agree. What about you, though? What are you listening to these days? Maybe I can take some suggestions for new sources.
I mean, usually the opening or ending themes of whatever anime I've been watching, so that. No, to your point of like music for media, a lot of the stuff that lives in my music library and has for a long time is either directly from like a film or a series or a trailer even. Just like that's one of the wilder things that I feel like I noticed as a kid was when a song would be featured in a movie trailer and then have no presence at all in the movie. And that sounds obvious as an adult. But as a kid, it was like, how did you choose that? Like, why this when it has no bearing on the film at large? I don't know why that popped into my head.
That's an interesting point, actually. And I don't know a whole lot about the industry of, you know, music supervisors, people who pick and sync music for movies and stuff, or for the trailer even. But it takes a pretty specific type of creativity to take an existing art form, so a song that somebody else wrote for a specific context, or, you know, wrote because they had a breakup song or something, and then take a different already imagined piece of art, the movie, and go, I think this song and this movie that were, you know, separately made, put together would be a great visual audio combination.
I feel like there was really specifically this culture, maybe it still exists, I just don't watch or find myself in proximity to this kind of media. Stuff like, you know, your Grey's Anatomies and your One Tree Hills, like when we were kids, every like season ender would have the new big single that no one had ever heard before and immediately becomes hugely popular. I always assume that it was like, oh, the studio that produced this show also has a record label arm, and it's like, ah, we will have a convergence of this new thing coming out. But in any case, there is that marriage. Very often, I feel like.
There is, weirdly enough, that you bring that up. I don't know about the actual job of being a music supervisor in the sense that I don't know how those creative decisions get made, but I do know there is a business angle to it because I did learn about that in music school, that they do work out deals like that with, you know, you've got these media conglomerates, right? You've got people who make that fund these films, these Hollywood big films, but then there is some I guess you could say, cross-pollination between those people and the people that distribute and do, you know, all the music that you hear on the radio, the top 40, the people who produce that, the people who, I guess you could say, lobby to have their music played the most on the radio.
Yeah.
There is some cross-pollination there. So some of it is just strictly business.
At least, I guess at a certain point, a less cynical way to look at that, or if we're looking at it cynically at all, is it narrows the field of options to, like, here's something we don't have to pay for because it exists within our sphere already.
Right, or they work out some kind of deal or something. And to your point, it is a very big field to be narrowed down. Like, the job of, what song should go in this spot in this movie isn't as simple as just picking the first song that pops in your head. You've got quite a database of songs to choose from.
Yeah. Backtracking slightly, do you have a favorite Ghibli or Miyazaki?
I feel like I recently tried to come up with like a ranking list with a friend. And I think, if I remember correctly, it was a pretty close tie between Princess Mononoke and Spirited Away.
Reasonable.
They're obviously pretty different, those two movies, but there's things about both of them that I like a lot. That would be hard for me to put one over the other. Obviously, Spirited Away is very fun and playful, but at the same time, you've got this kind of intense, this child is going through this very intense crisis. And then Mononoke is just, you know, an epic, like, creatures, and, you know, the creatures aren't as playful as in Mononoke as they are in Spirited Away, but you've got, either way, in both of them, they have a very, the story, it just feels like it has a lot of stakes to it. And obviously the music in both of them is amazing. And a lot of the art style of the two of them I like a lot. I don't know. Those are probably my favorite two.
Yeah, that makes total sense.
Yeah.
Now, the fun thing about Miyazaki is like the spectrum, right? Because like you have his very soft fairy tales. You have his huge epics. You have slice of life, adult drama, like shoot down the middle. My sister has been showing her 2-year-old son a lot of Ghibli. Like he just says, put on a Totoro. I want a Totoro. They are all Totoro, regardless of which film it is. Because Totoro's at the beginning of everyone. That makes sense in a 2-year-old brain.
Yeah.
But there are some that you would think he can handle, but he can't, and vice versa at 2, where like he loves Howl's Moving Castle. You know, Miyazaki's deeply emotional film about the Iraq War. He loves that one because, like, all of those deeper themes are kind of going over his head.
Right.
Where Spirited Away is filled with so much tension and dread of being a 12-year-old surrounded by these critters. They're like, no, he could not handle that right now.
That makes sense.
Yeah. Like, he's developing that kind of, like, screen-based empathy, I guess, rather than, like, context-based.
That makes sense. He sees it, and does it look familiar? Does it look comfortable? Does it look terrifying, like No Face, you know, for example, even though it's kind of like a playful thing, some of the images are like kind of, for a 2-year-old, just kind of like, what is that?
And I wonder if even at a certain point, it is a point in favor of the production as a whole, like whether that's soundscape or music or whatever, of like creating an atmosphere that just will create the emotional effect you want, even if you don't understand what's happening.
Absolutely. I think that, you know, a 2-year-old can hear a song and tell whether it is, you know, meant to be like danced to,
right,
or meant to tell you that there's danger or something like that, for example.
So going back to the Leprous Singer and sort of genre jumping slightly, obviously, you know, for the majority of time that we've known each other, I myself did not listen to a lot of like metal or hardcore or anything of that nature until hanging out with a bunch of guitar majors in college. And then that just kind of happens. So that's the sort of realm that I think of you associated with, you know, metal and prog. Whereas your personal stuff is much more in the ambient realm. Is that a transition that you've felt for yourself, or are they kind of two separate realms? Like, because your personal stuff is the more ambient now, where the bands you play with, whether because of your own creative output being that way collaboratively or just the bands you know in the scene in Nashville happen to be heavy. You know what I mean?
Right. I do think that there is a little bit of a separation there, but not so much that they are – it's not like, oh, I listened to metal in high school and now I don't. It's more of a, my tastes have expanded, and so I still like listening to and making the kind of heavier stuff and the proggy stuff, but I also really enjoy, and really always have, but just never realized that it was something that I could make, was, you know, the music that you hear in like a video game or in a movie that's a little bit more, I feel like the word ambient gets thrown around. Really what I just mean is music that is meant to be in the background, or music that can fade into the background and create a scene. But usually when you listen to it, it has a lot of detail in it.
Sure.
That like for that style has grown, and I've found that I enjoy making it. And that wasn't maybe necessarily the case when I first started, you know, playing guitar as like a teenager. I played video games and I liked the music in them, or I, you know, watched a movie and I thought the soundtrack was amazing, but it didn't click that, you know, there's no guitar in that. That's just electronic stuff. You know, as a kid, I'm playing guitar and I'm like, I want to play in a metal band. And so that's definitely changed over time. But, you know, you mentioned how Leprous is like a metal band. Like, Einar's solo album isn't really a metal album, his solo stuff. And so I think you find a lot of musicians that are in heavy bands, they also like to make other kinds of music, usually outside of the confines of that collaborative project, especially proggier bands that you can hear the different influences of a lot of different styles in their music. Bands like, I mean, Dream Theater, I guess, is like, they kind of get credited as one of the earlier prog metal bands, you know, as far as most of the bands today that make progressive music were probably influenced by them. Bands like Haken, bands like our friends in Kairos, who you've discussed creative things with before. Mm-hmm. You can hear all the different influences in the music they make. You can tell they don't just listen to metal or just listen to heavy music, because you can hear it seeping in the multi-genre aspect of the music they make. And so I think a lot of those people, given the opportunity, would make, if they made a solo album, it wouldn't be probably even heavy. A lot of people that make music at that level, like if you asked the lead singer of, I don't know, Dream Theater, which I guess he has some solo albums, but if you were like, hey, make whatever you want, they probably wouldn't make another Dream Theater album.
And sometimes it feels like, even apart from individual band members having their own solo stuff, that can happen like internally, right? Because where either a one-off album sounds super different, or the band slowly transforms, right? Like the slow popification of Genesis, or like In Through the Outdoor in the Led Zeppelin canon sounding super different.
Mm-hmm.
I want to circle back to video game stuff at a certain point, but talking about you and making ambient music and not knowing that that was a thing you wanted to do, that doesn't super surprise me that you now like to do that. I mean, is when we shared a room in college, I just remember how frequently you would be like looping and and just like creating guitar scapes while I would be like 6 foot off the ground on our rickety lofted beds. And that was deeply ambient to me. There's something about you making looping guitar scapes, soundscapes, is the only thing I can use to describe it, that I've wanted to ask you about for a while. There was this one day where you had been doing that and then you turned the pedal off and it all just kind of disappeared. And I was like, did you record that? And you said, no. I said, why? Well, I was just making stuff. And I don't know what it is about my vision of creativity. I know what it is, but it's for my therapist. that I was like, why didn't you record it? It's gone. And I don't know, something about your immense comfort with the ephemeral nature of that thing you were making has stuck with me for years.
Oh, interesting. I'm glad that that struck you in an interesting way. I don't even really remember making that.
Yeah, probably.
It didn't stick with me, which obviously that would be the the benefit of recording it, right? Would be that I could listen back to it. And I will say, I do listen back whenever I do record things, and I'm like, oh, I don't remember making this. And I could go two different ways with this. Like, on one hand, if you record everything all the time, you might want to use it later for something, and it could, maybe you hear it and it makes you, I guess I shouldn't speak for all creatives, but I know for myself and probably a lot of people, I think a lot of creatives have a lot of, they'll go through phases of self-doubt where they'll, you know, you might get like some imposter syndrome where you're like, why do I get to make this stuff? And what makes it any better than anybody else's? Like, what's the point? Kind of get existential about it sometimes. And listening back to things like that, and like, oh, I don't even remember making this, can be like reaffirming sometimes, or bring your focus back of like, oh yeah, I made this and I liked it. But on the other hand, I think that if you're constantly creating a pressure that I have to record this, I have to capture this, I need to make a thing that I can use later, changes your mindset while you're making it. There's a value in being in the moment. There's a value in just making something just for the sake of making it. Even if you don't save it or record it or use it for something, it can still be kind of therapeutic for you just to go through the process of making it. It can also spark ideas for other things. And I've had that happen before where I'll just kind of let my fingers wander if I'm playing piano or guitar and I'm not recording it, but I'm just kind of doing a musical stream of consciousness. And sometimes a song I'm working on will pop in my head as I'm doing this and I'm like, I know what that song needs now. So even if I'm not recording, it can still be beneficial for things I am working on. But at the same time, I'm willing to let that moment just be that moment and not always record everything.
Yeah, I feel like a similar thing for me as a writer is, God, I've just got hit by a huge wave of imposter syndrome, even calling myself one. Cool. Is a similar idea of like, if I have a string of words that just hits me in the shower or something, judging in that moment, like, do I need to write that down? Or was that just a thing that happened for me that I get like a little spark of satisfaction from and then I can move on? I don't need to attempt to codify or commodify what just happened. Yeah.
That's the other thing where, you know, you don't have to try to commodify it. But on the other hand, if you wrote it down, it might become useful later and then you might wish you had it. So recording isn't always, I need to use this later. And I think it is possible to hit record and then get in the right mindset to be in the moment to where you don't get red light syndrome or you don't have a mindset of I need to create something in order for it to be used and still capture it. I think that's possible.
Can we speak on red light syndrome?
Yeah.
I don't know what that means.
Red light syndrome is just, so like, let's say that you sit down. Do you still have my bass?
I play it once a week.
Awesome.
I make myself play bass for a couple hours every week so I don't lose my calluses.
Very nice. So like, imagine you're sitting down with your bass and you're practicing a specific song. Maybe it's a little tricky for you, but you practice once a week for, I don't know, a month or two, and you're like, okay, I got this song down. Now I want to record it. So you hit the red light, you hit record on your computer, and suddenly you're like, oh, I have to play this and capture it perfectly. Red light syndrome is just, I'm recording now, and suddenly it's kind of similar to like stage fright.
Sure.
It's like stage fright, but for recording.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
On like the joy of just making something, the thing I think about frequently is there's this story that I am assuming is true, but even if it's just a story, it's fine, about an author I've never read, Kurt Vonnegut, where when he was much older, a elementary school or middle school like reached out to him asking for advice or something. And he wrote back a letter saying, like, and I believe he was fairly old at this point, maybe his early 80s. He said, I have an assignment for all of your students. Go home, write a poem, put it in an envelope and bury it. Do not show it to anyone. Never show it to anyone. That is the assignment, to make a thing without caring about what it would be like to show it to anyone. And obviously that's not like the thing you should do with all the things you make, because sharing the things you make is an immense joy.
Absolutely.
But there's an important lesson in there.
There is. And it's also something that I have found, I have been very hesitant and maybe anxious even about showing my work to others, especially my own music that I'm maybe a little bit more protective of versus, you know, if I'm in a band and I'm contributing ideas to a project and they get put through that filter first of, you know, co-writing, that's, I feel a little bit more confident in, because, okay, I got it affirmed and maybe reworked even with the talents of a couple other people, and that gives it a little bit more authority to it versus if I just put a song out that just I made, there's no other creative force involved, and it's just, this is just what I made, and so if it's not liked, it's not the same as if someone doesn't like my band, because it's just me. So maybe I'm a little bit more protective. of my own music. But I have only really recently started to learn that it's okay to share things and maybe not be as like, who cares if it's not perfect? Like, I've only just started to lose some of that perfectionism and sort of that fear of what people will think about it. And I think that burying the poem story is part of what's gotten me there. The idea that, well, I'm going to make a bunch of things and I'm not going to share all of them, but I'm going to make it and I'm not going to care how it turns out. And by doing that, I start to accept my own creativity a little bit more. And then I just start to say, okay, I made all this stuff. I'm going to pick some of my favorites to share with people. If they don't like it, that's okay. I have all this other stuff and I enjoy the process of making all of this. But there is still a little bit of, it's a combination of like imposter syndrome, red light syndrome, anxiety, just kind of like self-doubt. There's all these, you know, negative self-talk traps that artists face. And maybe there's a little bit of selfishness in there too, but you face all these things and it can make it hard to share an idea or share a song that you're working on sometimes.
Yeah. Before I say the thing I wanted to say, I should point out, I pretty heavily paraphrased that Vonnegut story. Feel free to go fact check me yourself, listeners. But yeah, in terms of like a thing that hit me like a freight train not too long ago is that creativity, when it's not collaborative, when it's just you, is kind of a relationship with yourself.
Absolutely.
And the fact that like the longer you're alive, your relationship to yourself is ever changing. And so the relationship to what creativity looks like is going to be constantly shifting and sometimes way harder than others.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, if you look at, and this is in a band setting, so obviously there's more factors than just the individual, but if you look at a band that gets kind of thrown under the bus by their fans for making the quote-unquote the same album again, you know, are those artists fulfilled in making it or are they growing? And the thing is, you might, like you said, you might keep changing over your life and that might change the way you relate to music. But, you know, it's kind of like going to a restaurant and ordering the same thing every time you go there. Are you ordering it because you're picky and don't want to eat anything else, or are you ordering it because you know it's the thing you like the most on there? So I think even an artist or a band that kind of keeps making similar things, it can still be true to themselves. They can still be growing and changing. Even if they're making something similar, it's just what they want to make sometimes.
Yeah, and I feel like people who are fans of media specifically can maybe get a little hung up sometimes on it being the thing they like. Two things that I've tried to live by in the last several years, because I care about a lot of different kinds of media a lot, and it's what I spend my time thinking about, I discovered some ways in which looking at them started to feel better, both for me and the people making it. The first being that there's a huge difference between things that are bad and things that are not for me.
Absolutely.
It's okay for things to not be for you. Mm-hmm. And tied almost inextricably to that is the like Roger Ebert school of criticism, like the film critic, which his sort of mode of criticism was when you go into a film, you are judging it, criticizing it, or you should, based on what the film is trying to do, not what you thought the film was going to be or what you think it should be doing, like what it was trying to do, which has an inherent respect for the people who made it.
Right.
So the people who are upset that another album has come out by the same band that sounds exactly the same as the last one, they can be disappointed that there wasn't a new sound, but they should not be able to necessarily blame the people making it.
Right.
Because you came back to this band who's done that many times before. What did you expect?
Right, exactly. And it's not – I think people that complain about that are maybe preemptively judging these artists – like, oh, they're not growing. And that's – I was just thinking of that in relation to what you were talking about, how, you know, an individual – you know, your relationship with yourself is changing over your life. And you would expect that, you know, a band, that their music would evolve over their career. Mm-hmm. And a lot of – I will say a lot of the artists that I really like a lot do that. You know, like Leprous, for example, like their music, like every album sounds pretty substantially different than the previous. And I would like to think that's because they're being – true to themselves and their relationship with themselves is changing over time, like you say. But I don't think that a band that puts the same album out over and over isn't necessarily being true to themselves either. And I would think, too, to talk to what we were talking about, maybe some of the self-doubt that one might face, I would think that looking at criticism from the lens that you're talking about, where there's things that are for you, and then there's things that are bad versus things that are just not for you. And I think recognizing that can be a source of confidence.
Yeah,
when when you're releasing your own writing. All right, this is my writing. I know it's not for everybody, and accept that. And not just when somebody doesn't like it. That doesn't mean it's bad. It just means it wasn't for them.
Right.
I think that can be a source of positive reinforcement for an artist to actually release their creation and share it with people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's this idea that gets bandied around a lot of like, do not write for the bad faith reader. It's not for them,
right?
Because they're going to read it in bad faith anyway.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Something I definitely wanted to talk about and don't want to keep forgetting about it before we run out of time. I don't think it would be untoward to say that back in college, you were not a vocalist.
Not at all.
So like, your voice now is gorgeous.
Thank you.
What spurred that, and what was that process like of developing your voice?
Well, I'm still actively working on it, and the thing that I've learned about the voice is that because it is part of your body, like it's an instrument, but it's also your physical body, your relationship with it changes as your body changes, and your mindset and understanding of that instrument is linked to how you understand yourself in a way that you're, you know, learning an instrument isn't. Right? Like when you play a middle C on a piano, it's always going to be middle C. When you sing a middle C, you have to be aware of the actual feeling of how all your muscles feel to create that, because your muscles are part of the instrument.
Yeah.
So it's been a journey of self-awareness in a lot of ways for me that I wasn't expecting. But I'd say what spurred it was really just the same thing that spurred me to learn about the production process that I didn't learn while I was in music school, was I want to make my own music. And so out of necessity and curiosity to explore, you know, I've gradually over the past, I guess, 7 years since we graduated, been making my own music and taking the steps to learn all of the individual pieces along the way that I didn't learn while I was in school, to get from the idea in my head to a finished song that someone can listen to. And there's a lot of self-doubt when it comes to singing, just because it's the main thing that people will probably judge when they listen to a song. You know, like if I was writing everything for it and then getting somebody else to come in and sing it, I'm not going to feel as bad if somebody's like, oh, those vocals aren't very good, versus, you know, if I did it myself and it was all my music, it's a little more intimidating that way, especially as somebody that doesn't have a vocal background. But, you know, I've been taking vocal lessons and I just try to make it a point to sing every day, and I think everyone really should. Honestly, I think everybody could benefit from just singing their favorite song every once in a while.
Yeah, no, when I didn't have like a job to commute to for a few years, that was something I noticed missing, was the like just screaming angry songs in my car after I clock out of work. It's like, yes, get rid of the stress. It is immensely therapeutic. Like very few things are, to just be loud. and even if you're not loud, to exercise like the muscles that you have to like express yourself vocally. Like
where
I'm starting to make this sound way more highfalutin than it is. It just feels good. I would be very curious to have like, I don't know, some kind of like stress test going on you, like a heart monitor or what have you, for like before and after and during while doing something like singing that's so physical of like what it does to you.
Yeah, it regulates your breath and it's more expressive than speaking. Mm-hmm. You know, just like when you listen to a song, it can make you feel things that you may not even be able to put into words. The same goes for singing. When you sing, you're expressing something that you couldn't express by just saying it, right? There's a reason. I don't know if you've ever done this. Have you ever read the lyrics to a song and been like, wow, this is really like cheesy or like silly? But when it's sung, it's actually impactful because you're saying something you couldn't say with those words if you just spoke them.
True. I said I wanted to circle back to video games, so I think we should do that. I know what the main answer will be if I ask what video games have inspired you musically, but do you think there has been a direct line from video game music to the more ambient sound of your stuff?
Absolutely.
And is it anything other than Metroid?
No, it's really Metroid. That was kind of what sparked me to... It was one of a couple dominoes very early on in leading me to being a musician, ultimately. Mm. Other ones being that I just really enjoyed singing as a kid. And then, I enjoyed playing guitar when I was pretty young. But the music in those games was some of the first music I heard that made me want to write music, because I remember I had a friend. So Metroid... I believe the second Prime game for the GameCube had just come out. We were like, in middle school, and we were like, let's make the third Prime game for the it hadn't been announced yet, but we knew it was a trilogy. Mm-hmm. So we were like, eventually a Prime 3 is going to come out. But we had this fantasy of let's make our own Metroid Prime 3. And so, I'm 10 or 11 and I'm sitting at my piano in my living room and I'm like, the first level will be called, I don't remember, the Ancient Fortress, whatever. And so I'd sit there and play like, what would that fortress sound like? And it was kind of what got me to start tinkering with composing in the first place.
Wow.
And so that's definitely made its way into my own music now that I've kind of transcended beyond thinking of myself as a guitarist, which, weirdly enough, my guitar teacher at Belmont was a big part in helping me see myself as a musician, not just as a guitarist. That's a whole story. But now that I'm like, okay, I don't have to make music with guitar in it. And I've learned how to, produce music in a sense that from idea in head to sounds in your computer, I can do that whole process now by myself. It makes it easier to make the music that sounds like what I wanted to make as a kid. Mm. The music that would be the backdrop for some kind of adventure. And I think that's why I also gravitated towards prog, because I think a lot of prog music has that kind of adventurous spirit to it, but it's a little more overstated electronic music.
Yeah, it's sort of direct line to more storytelling rather than just like a vibe.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
I think that's about all I wanted to talk about, and I think we've certainly talked about plenty of things.
We have talked about a lot of things.
About the last hour or so, but thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me. This was a great conversation.
Yeah. We'll put whatever links you see fit to your stuff in the description of this podcast by the time it comes out.
Of course.
And thank you all for listening. We greatly appreciate it. And as a reminder, this podcast is only possible because of the Nashville Public Library, so I would encourage everyone to go get a library card. And as a little encouraging tidbit, I like to say things that you may not know you can do with your library card. At least at time of recording, you can get a $10 a month printing credit so that next time you need to print out a packing slip for a return item or a boarding pass or something, maybe think about the library, because you can probably do that for free if you live in Davidson County. Thank you very much.